Hype Man, Raj Nation, the GOAT, GOAT to Market. From Hype HQ in Chicago, Illinois, Startup Hype Man presents the GOAT to Market Show. What's up, everyone? I am your host, Raj Nation, the founder and chief pitch artist of Startup Hype Man. This podcast is where we bring you founders, company leaders, and creatives who are building it, who are doing it, who have been there and done that. And they pull back the curtain on their go-to-market strategies so that you can build a venture that you love and become the GOAT of your industry. Want first listen on episodes before anyone else? Subscribe to our newsletter at startuphypeman.com. You will get alerts every Sunday morning when we release new episodes. All right, let's hear how today's guest is becoming the GOAT. What's up, everyone? It's Raj Nation, the Startup Hype Man, here coming to you with a special treat this week on the GOAT to Market Show. Now, in addition to running Startup Hype Man, I also have the honor of being the chapter director for Startup Grind Chicago. Startup Grind is a global startup community with over 600 chapters around the world, and I run the Chicago chapter. Today on the GOAT to Market Show, we're sharing my recent fireside chat interview at Startup Grind Chicago with Trisha Martinez Saab. Trisha is the managing director of Techstars Chicago, focused specifically on investing in AI and deep tech verticals. In this interview, we talked about investing in AI, the future of AI. What are the things that startups need to consider with building AI products, and so much more? It was really a masterclass in understanding how AI is shaping our future. Now, one quick heads up here. Trisha was supposed to appear in person that night for this interview. However, she ended up getting COVID. So last minute, we called an audible and we did a me live in the room with our event and Trisha on a big screen zooming in from home. So if you hear a little bit of audio discrepancy, it's because Trisha's there on Zoom and she's broadcasting to us through a TV screen and I'm on a microphone in front of a live audience at the room. Enjoy this special edition episode of Startup Hype Man's Go to Market Show. It's building in and investing in AI with Trisha Martinez Saab of Techstars Chicago, live from Startup Grind Chicago. Everybody, in traditional Startup Grind fashion, whenever we bring our main speaker onto the stage, we like to act like it is Beyonce coming out on stepping onto Soldier Field. So everybody, do me a favor, stand up, and I'm going to introduce Trisha, our speaker for tonight. Please welcome Trisha Martinez. All right, beautiful. Trisha, thank you for still grinning and bearing it even while being down with the flu. Really appreciate you. And I don't know, this is kind of a cool setup that we still have. You're able to see everyone, and this is
impressive. I love this. It's a really great turnout too.
So we just came off having six different companies pitch and showcase, a couple of which I know are in your portfolio. You know, Anthony Santos being one of them. I'm going to ask the hard question right off the bat. So we are both DePaul University alum. We probably had a year of overlap. What was your go-to campus bar?
I have no memory. I honestly don't know. And that might sound bad, like I was partying. I really wasn't. I just was like, I feel like I was studying so much. I did undergrad and I went straight to grad school at University of Chicago. And like, I just feel like I was kind of lame. I didn't go out much. I'm like Kirkland's, is that one? I feel like maybe on Sheffield.
Kirkwoods.
Yeah. Kirkland's is Costco. Kirkwoods, I think I lived over there and would hang out at that spot for a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. I don't have like a go-to. What was your go-to?
Probably
Kincaid's.
Oh, I feel like I remember that. And I was like, that's not the place I wanted to hang out at.
Well, I think your memoir can be titled From Kirkwoods to Kirkland's, The Story of Growing Up. All right, so you are the managing director at Techstars Chicago. You're doing a lot of investing in AI. You've got a pretty extensive history being involved in AI. I think you were doing AI before it was cool. And you're a past founder yourself. You founded three different companies.
When I was looking through your history, these are companies that were founded like literally around the world. Can you talk about how you got that global experience and just let our audience know here, like just quick background on what these different companies were? And it was across like blockchain and a few other things too, some of the more advanced yeah. technologies. And they were literally, you know, founded in different parts of the world. How did that come about?
Yeah. So, you know, long story short, I like to tell people that I'm just super passionate about far out ideas that can change the world. So I've always been attracted to novel things. I felt like if we're going to solve some of our greatest challenges, we need to do things differently. And so I saw technology as a way to open the floodgates and be that driver to one, solve problems, but then scale those solutions. So I, from a young age, was like, I want to solve problems. And I originally thought policy was the way to do that. So I studied economics and policy in undergrad and grad school and thought I was going to run for office, and had some time at the Illinois state legislature and was like, oh boy, this is not for me. Very slow, bureaucratic, lacking innovation. And I just felt like we could do so much more. And I was pretty disappointed in the people we were electing into office. And that's when I did took some, like, I participated in the New Venture Challenge at Booth and was like, oh my gosh, you can start businesses and solve really big problems. I didn't realize like you could pair together impact and business. And that's when I just fell madly in love with entrepreneurship. Started my first business in grad school. I raised a venture fund in grad school to basically, like, we started an accelerator in Chicago called Nueva Labs to invest in traditionally underserved founders. 1871 was opening at the time. I was one of the first members, and I looked around and I was like, one, I'm definitely the only woman, but 100% the only Latina. And that really concerned me that we were creating this, you know, boys only club. And I wanted to make sure that entrepreneurs who are operating in the non-traditional silos could get access to the resources they needed to be successful. So I ended up raising like $500,000 from mainly Latino angel investors across Illinois. And then I was like, you know, I want to go build something myself. I don't necessarily want to run accelerators. I'm back in accelerator. So I've come full circle, but I wanted to go build. And I studied a lot about poverty alleviation and microfinance in undergrad and graduate school, and wanted to invest my time in financial inclusion. My family's from Mexico, so I grew up going back and forth. And from a very young age, I always felt like, statistically speaking, what are the odds that I was born into a middle-class family in America? This, you know, the chances are just very low. I should have been born into poverty, into a third world country. And because I have this privilege, I want to use it to go help people that don't have that privilege. And so I ended up going to Sub-Saharan Africa, mainly because microfinance was very effective within those regions. You know, even though my family was in Mexico and Latin America, everyone's like, why didn't you go there? I just kind of felt like I wanted to go to the extreme, and poverty was most extreme in Africa. And so I ended up going to Uganda. I raised like $50,000 from angels in Chicago. And I told them, I was like, look, I want to go give this money away to people. I'm just going to give it to 100 farmers and let's just see what happens. And we, of course, lo and behold, it was very effective. So unconditional cash transfers, if any of you are familiar with the organization Give Directly, it's the most effective poverty alleviation intervention. Basically, a no strings attached cash grant. As a foreigner, I don't know how to invest in your life. You know better how to empower yourself. So I'm going to give you the money to do it. So we gave people a year's worth of income in northern Uganda. These were subsistence farmers, people living off of the land, and they invested in their children, their businesses, their homes. But the most difficult thing we dealt with wasn't giving them money. It was the actual process of physically moving money to them. No one wanted to use banking. No one wanted to use mobile money, which is, some of you might have heard of M-Pesa, telecom communications companies providing the ability to text money to people. And so the infrastructure was just non-existent. And that's when this opportunity arose, and I was like, we should be building something here. We should understand the disparities at a deeper level that exist within the financial sectors across Sub-Saharan Africa and see how we can make a dent. And so I started engaging deeply with consumers on the ground. And I wouldn't even say, like, people living in extreme poverty. These were emerging middle class consumers that were college educated, living in the large cities, that were choosing not to use banks, that were saving money under their mattresses because they just didn't trust the systems and because it was so expensive. Everything is very cost prohibitive in these markets. So to go to the bank, they charge you. To check your balance, they charge you. To do any action comes with a fee. And so people are just disincentivized from using it. And that's when we said, like, let's create a new system. Let's work with the banks. We'll go acquire customers for them. We won't charge fees. They'll grow really fast at scale. This could be, a massive revenue generator because later on you could provide loans and insurance products. And long story short, the banks that we worked with realized we were going to cannibalize their business. We worked for 3 years and couldn't get the product off into the market with a bank that we worked with across the continent. And then we ended up saying we have to go the blockchain route. There's no other option. So before people were doing ICOs, we did one, a small, I hate talking about it because I then became into this weird crypto world, which I was like, this is not the world I want to be in. But we felt like forced because we had a community of over 1 million consumers in Africa who signed up for our product. It was insane. And so we were desperate to get them something to help them. And so we ended up launching a product on blockchain. People could send payments cross-border instantly at no cost. We didn't charge them anything. They could pay for their bills, they could, like, their electricity and their phone. Do all these things through our platform, no fees. And so we blew up. We grew so insanely fast. And because we grew so insanely fast, we ran into so many problems. Fraud, systems kept breaking. We couldn't grow quick enough. And then the crypto winter hit. We lost our lead investors. We ended up, Santos knows the story. I need to write a book about it. We ended up working with the Chinese government. They were investing in us and they acquired us. And then we ended up having to part ways because it was just a really weird engagement. And so my heart broke with it because we didn't get to fulfill what we wanted to. It was the longest startup journey. It was almost 10 years. It was like 7, 8 years. And so I learned a lot, lived in sub-Saharan Africa, traveled across, probably visited and worked in over 30 countries of the 54 countries. And built and grew a team of over 30 people on the ground in Cape Town, South Africa. So it was the most incredible life experience. I learned so much and learned all the things you definitely shouldn't do as a founder. And so it was exciting for me to go back to Techstars because we took our company through the accelerator, but come back to Techstars and then work with great founders to help them not make the mistakes that I did.
Now, aside from, maybe perhaps thinking twice about partnering with a foreign government, is there like what's something you learned from the startup not working out that you now give that as advice to the founders you invest in?
So I was, when I look back at myself now as an investor, looking at myself as a founder, I'm like, would I have invested in myself? And like part of me is like, yes, I was gritty as hell. Like I was like, I will stop at nothing. And that's why we didn't die sooner, because I was like, I'm just not gonna allow us to die. We'll keep going. I will find a way. But what I was so stubborn about as a founder was the business model. Like I was like, it has to be free. It has to be zero fees. And that's not sustainable. And that's really what like a lot of investors were like, you can't possibly have a free model. Like you have to start charging at some point. And in my mind, I was like, yes, at scale, we'll introduce additional financial products and then start charging. I wanted to create a network effect. But so I wish I had been more less stubborn and maybe a little bit more coachable. And I really was beat up when when an investor or somebody like a partner or a customer wasn't interested. Like I made it my life's mission to try to persuade them to change them. And it's like, that's okay. Not everyone's going to believe in you or what you're doing. Like you're going to have a lot of people who think you're going to fail, and that's totally fine. But I would get caught up on a lot of those things. And so like looking at my former self, it doesn't make me sad. It's just like I've grown so much as a person, and now I know I wouldn't make that mistake. But I pushed a lot of the founders I work with that it's like, you just got to brush dust off your shoulders, like move on. It's not worth the agony.
After you finished your time abroad, you ended up, you know, you mentioned earlier that you thought you'd become a politician. Now, you ended up being a White House fellow, and you worked as part of their program to help, like, craft AI strategy or show how they could use AI with this. Talk to us about that experience. Like, what exactly were you responsible for, and what was the program for?
Yeah, so that was such a cool experience. It was the point at which my, you know, we basically shut down Walla. It was this failed acquisition. I was personally devastated and embarrassed. I was like, I want to tell people I had a winning acquisition. Like, and I still have that chip on my shoulder, the founder. I'm like, I need to go out and build and just have a successful exit. I don't know why. That's like one of my insecurities. I just have to say, I just want to be able to say that. So I was just like, oh my God, everyone's going to think I'm a loser and I'm a failure. And so like, I was just like so insulated. And I was like, I don't fit anywhere. I have to go start another business, or what else am I going to do? No one's going to hire, you know, a 10-year founder. So I was like, what do I do next? And then, you know, I was like, I have all these skills, like so much experience internationally building things. I want to go give back to my country. So I thought being a fellow, and I wanted to understand, you know, the deeper inner workings of the federal government. And I saw the opportunity around climate change. I wanted to position myself as a potential climate entrepreneur because, you know, more and more for me, I'm like, the only thing that matters is solving the problems. Our biggest challenge right now is the climate battle. But I was like, I don't know the energy systems at all. I need to understand at an inner working. And so the fellowship was awesome. I got detailed to the Department of Energy, the AI and Technology Office. So DOE set up an AI office to develop and define a strategy around AI and climate for the nation. And so basically, how does AI impact our energy systems? How can we use it to address the climate battle? So a lot of research and strategy and trying to like, one, it was a lot of mobilization of the greater DOE ecosystem. So one of my strategies was I wanted to educate all the DOE workforce on like, what is AI? How do I think about this? How is it going to impact my role? How does it impact energy markets? And at the time, everyone's like, who cares? AI is stupid. I'm like, so it was a struggle just because it wasn't a cool thing at that point in time. It was one of like one of the funnest jobs I had. And just being able, it was another struggle to try to influence people on something novel to get them prepared for what is to come, how it will impact them. But mainly, like, this is a tool that can be utilized to address some of our large challenges and create a lot of efficiency. And so as a federally funded agency, we should be looking at this because it's our taxpayer dollars and it's worth us investing in it.
Which administration was this under?
So I was under both. So, you know, I don't like talking about politics. I don't know who's in the office. I'll just say I'm insanely progressive. But I joined under Trump and was like, you know, it's a bipartisan fellowship. So that was also a strange experience being at the Department of Energy during Republican administration, because, you know, DOE didn't want to, you know, acknowledge climate change at the beginning. And then when Biden came in, it was like, everything's climate change, we're switching gears. So like the whole experience was just very insane, just going from one president to another and seeing the turnover and the chaos and like what was happening.
So more recently, President Biden issued that executive order around, I believe, like responsible, like trying to create some standards for responsible AI development. What do you feel is, like, does government play a role in AI? Should they be involved? And if so, what capacity?
Yeah, 100% government plays a role. So, I mean, we can look at other sectors. I feel like government didn't step in around blockchain soon enough. And like we saw that ICO craze and so many people lost so much money around the world. Like it's just terrible what has happened. There's been a lot of fraud. And so when the government doesn't step in, bad things can happen, because when you have new emerging technologies, there's always going to be a bad actor. That's now what's happening, right? Like I tell people we had crypto bros and now they're turning to AI bros. And unfortunately there are people who are just like, I'm on the bandwagon and I'm going to try to like get as much money and opportunity as I can. And so that's noise and you have to turn that off. But the difficult thing with government is they don't know. Like, it's moving way too fast for them to keep up. And the White House or any administration, it doesn't matter, Republican or Democrat, like, they can create committees. They can create like high, very well-positioned corporate leaders to be part of these committees, but it's just not going to do enough fast enough. And so that's the concern is government wants to influence, but they just literally don't have the ability because it's moving too quickly. You know, too much government interference is a bad thing because then it deters innovation. And then a lot of AI startups are going to struggle and they won't be able to build, you know. And so the idea of like a sandbox, things like that are really great. However, like, this was one of the issues I dealt with at DOE, that like, you know, bureaucratic individuals, federal employees have no idea what these technologies are. But I would say 99.9% of people don't know what they are, and that's okay. They don't need to. But as AI is going to influence drastically society and every facet of our life, we need to have more people understand. And so I don't think the government is set up right now to support regulation and or really understand it, the technology at a deeper level, which is the more concerning part.
So let's continue on the theme of concerns. I think there's been a lot of growth. Obviously, we've seen there's been a lot of tons of growth in AI over the last year. It went from something that was like kind of out there to all of a sudden like a household word, and every company now is like, oh, we're using Gen AI in this way or that way. You recently posted a pretty interesting video series around the roadblocks and challenges to being able to effectively scale AI. And you kind of outlined like four key areas. One of those was energy consumption. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, I mean, something that a lot of people don't think about, and this goes with many of the, what I would call like the industries of the future, novel technologies. So we have AI, quantum, advanced manufacturing, like any novel technology that requires a lot of data and processing. We don't think about what goes on behind the scenes, but like to make AI work, you just have to process absurd amounts of data. And imagine like now we're talking like AI and steroids. So like every company is going to be using AI and everyone's going to be building all these things. So that ends up requiring a lot of large data centers. And, you know, I invested in a company that was building a novel liquid cooling technology for data centers because they can't cool fast enough. And we're just processing so much data, which is scary. And, you know, the prediction is that like 1/4 of our world's energy consumption is going to be driven by data centers alone, which is terrifying. You know, that's the future, and we're not anywhere near that right now, but that's a big challenge that we're going to be up against. That like, if we continue down this path of rapid, you know, AI and data usage, we're going to have to build energy solutions in order to support that system.
The other roadblocks that you've talked about before are the data gap, the talent gap, and then AI having
bias.
Can you talk about those challenges and why they're challenges and what we can do about them?
Yeah, so I mean, I would say probably like the biggest opportunity and drawback of AI is data. Like it's a gold. And a lot of companies, startups at least, forget that like in order to build AI models, you need tons and tons of data. You have to build the models and you have to train the models. And so it can be difficult, right? When they're proprietary data, there's not unlimited public data. And when there is public data available, oftentimes that data needs to be cleaned, right? Like you end up spending, I think there's a stat that I read that I made note of, that like 80% of your time when you're launching an AI project is spent wrangling data and then labeling it. And so it's not a very efficient model, right? Like right now we don't have like an easy way to consume data and capture it. And a lot of data that does exist, right? Like Facebook or Meta, Right, like all these social media platforms, Netflix, like they all own their data. That's all proprietary. And so we're great. They have loads of data and get to use it, but nobody else can. And so if you're a startup trying to build in a space, finding data is going to be the hardest part. And if you end up being a B2B company working with an enterprise, they're going to be very data sensitive and they're not going to want to share all that data. And that's like one of the biggest hurdles in getting over working with a lot of these enterprises. So data is gold, and being able to figure out like, how can we easily generate data? How can we create more data with the customers we're working with, or how can we access public data that's, you know, doesn't require us to spend all of our energy cleaning it and labeling it. So that's something definitely to think about. The other piece that I get worried about is the talent gap. Like, this was something I spent a lot of time on at DOE, especially as we look at, you know, more adversarial countries. You know, China is a leader in AI education. They're pumping AI PhDs like no other. They have universities, brand new universities set up just for AI. And so like, they're just training so many people so quickly. And we have one of the smallest percentages of AI trained individuals. And so like, I think it's like 3% of the American workforce actually has technical skills to work in AI. And that doesn't mean like we can't start training people, but you know, not everyone's getting their PhD. Do you need a PhD to build an AI? No. But you need to have at least some sort of data background, right? Like, we need data scientists. We need product people that know how to build with it. We need developers, front end and back end, and people who understand how to utilize these different algorithms and models. And so it's not easy. And there are more and more programs and like certificates coming up, but it's still a really big gap. And probably one of the biggest hurdles that most of the companies I work with is finding really great AI talent, because now everyone wants AI talent and people are willing to pay obscene amounts of data for it. And so you're just going to have to compete and try to find anything. And so as a worker, I would say like, go educate yourself, build up more of an AI skill set, because you're going to have the opportunity then to sell your talent and make a lot more money. But as a nation, like, that's something that the US should be focused on, is really investing in our workforce and, you know, upskilling a lot of the people and building up more programs so we see more PhDs and leadership in the AI space.
Do you think that I'll come to that fourth one in a second, but a quick follow-up to that. Do you think we're going to see more jobs get converted to the job is training you how to use AI to do the job?
Yeah. So I think that, again, like, one, there's like all the, there's so much fear still around people losing their jobs. And that's like, again, some of the companies that I work with, they are struggling in that, like, in the sales cycle that they have and trying to sell the enterprise. Some of these, you know, let's say mid-level managers are like, actually, I don't really want to have introduce this to my boss because this means my job might not exist. So a lot of people have fear and recognize that some of the work that they're doing are these mundane tasks. And that's also a problem. Like, we don't need everyone to be doing these types of things. There's a lot of roles like legal and then finance and accounting that like humans may not have to be doing that. And that's okay. That means you can be empowered to do something else and manage that AI, manage that tool. And so there's a fear that like you're getting replaced, but in reality, there's a lot of data out there that shows we're going to be creating way more jobs with more AI in the system, just because we need more highly skilled and trained people to be able to manage these technologies.
The other roadblock you've talked about is bias. What goes into that, and what's the challenge, and what do we do about it?
Yeah, so I mean, bias is probably, I would say, outside of data, is like, this is a part of the data problem, but this is a massive, massive problem. And it's scary because it's going to bite us in the ass years from now. And we're going to be like, well, shit, we should have invested more into this. The issue with bias is just that we as humans are training AI and we have explicit bias. Like, we can't change that. That's just how society is. But it ends up creating massive problems when we deploy the technology. So like, if I've given an example to people around like video surveillance technology, that like whoever is, you know, training the AI and also whoever is capturing the data, right? Like, it's not surprising that like Black and brown men you know, that we're focusing explicitly on them, or that we can't tell the difference between their facial features because of the people who are training these models and also the data that we're originally training it from. And so it's hard. There are a lot of like nonprofits that are popping up now to help address this. And there's a lot of science and like there are people who have PhDs in this, which is amazing. And it's super, super important and something that we really need to be thinking about, because it is scary to live in a world where we have AI that could be making a lot of decisions for businesses and for even our government. And if the data is flawed, or if people are programming these technologies that have some sort of bias, it could leave women in a shitty situation. It could leave Black and brown people in a shitty situation. And so like we have to be super aware and conscious of what's happening in order to protect all of our society.
We'll be back with more of my interview with Trisha Martinez Saab in just a moment. But first, I've got a message for you, friends. I want to talk to you about my new friends, and those are my friends at Active Campaign. Look, I'm going to be real with you. After about 10 years, I finally was able to get out of a long, abusive, toxic relationship with MailChimp. That's right, I dropped the chimp and I swapped it for the goat. Active Campaign is the goat of marketing automation, because let me tell you this, whether you're a B2B SaaS, a marketplace, a consumer app, a services business like Startup Hype Man, or anything in between, every kind of business needs a newsletter. And from setup to send, every newsletter we have published has been a 10 times easier experience since switching to Active Campaign. They've got tons of integration, so hooking up anything I already have into Active Campaign is super easy. Automations are made simple. It's like a drag and drop interface. It's just like super easy to work with. And I think my favorite part is actually supportive customer support. I'm not sent through like a long ticketing system. There's not an annoying chatbot I have to deal with. All in all, I no longer feel restricted by my software. Not to mention, they make all the data migration from your previous provider so quick and easy. I honestly had to actually ask multiple times, what more am I supposed to be doing here? Because it was that painless and that hands-off. I want you to experience this type of relationship. You might be in a toxic relationship right now with your current marketing automation system, or maybe you don't have one yet. Well, in either scenario, I want you to get the goat of marketing automation, and I want you to be in a blooming, healthy, and beautiful relationship. You can get your free 2-week trial by tapping on the link in this episode description. Back now to the interview.
So having understood those challenges, what role does Techstars hope to play in the advancement of AI?
So Techstars is right. Like we're the largest, most active early stage investor. Every program is different. And so I would say like Techstars wants to be at the, you know, the forefront of what's to come. So excited about any technology that could be truly innovative and revolutionary. I would say I'm probably an outlier at Techstars, because I like, you know, I'm someone who doesn't like the traditional, you know, I'm not like a consumer investor or a generalist. Like I like big, crazy ideas. I like deep tech. I like things that are really hard, and clunky and require a lot of science and research and government funding. Because like for me as an investor, I'm like, why not? Why wouldn't we back the things? We need to invest trillions of dollars and make a lot of mistakes to learn so that we can get it right the next time. And so that's basically where my head's at. Like with the Chicago program, I just want to invest in as many amazing AI founders that we can across everything. So from biotech to HR to procurement to finance, like whatever it is, this tool could disrupt industries. It could solve really big problems. And we need to keep learning on how to improve the technology. But from here, it will only enable us to solve more problems. So I think, you know, I would say I'm an outlier at Techstars in that regard. I like crazy, wacky ideas. Like the crazier, the better if your impact is large.
So had you been here earlier, you would have seen the six companies we had showcasing tonight. You would have been able to see them pitch and see a little bit about their product. One of the companies you already have invested in, but you know, I'm sure these other five who are here are like, I wonder what it would take to get on Trisha's radar. So generally, like when you're making investment decisions, specifically within AI, what are the things you're looking for in a company?
So I want to see, so it's a few things. First, as founder, you know, why are you doing this in the first place? Are you gritty enough to keep it pushing forward? Who's on your team? Like, why is this the team that you've built? So like, team is, you know, above all anything. And with team comes traction. So like, I tell founders generally, like, I like to talk to you for months and months. I don't want you to just apply, because I want to know you. I want to have conversations with you. I want to understand what motivates you, and also see how quickly you can move. And sometimes how quickly you can move is dictated by the market. But it also speaks to you and your hustle and like the hunger you have. So traction is really important. I'm also, like I said, like I'm a technophile. So I love technology, and I'm really intrigued by the problem. So like, the reason why I became a founder was because I was so fascinated by this problem that existed. And I was fascinated why we didn't have a solution to this problem. And I'm addicted to figuring out how we solve problems. And so I gravitate towards problems that I like a lot, and that I'm really curious about. And so that's generally how I look at companies. And then of course, market is something like, is this, you know, is there a significant market opportunity? Is this going to happen in the next year? Are we talking 10 years from now? And that can be hard with deep tech or, right, some of this AI stuff, right? Like, we have a mix. There are companies that are application layer that are potentially like AI or ChatGPT wrappers, which is not a bad thing. If you plan to be that forever, that's bad. But like, if you're just getting out, you know, to test and validate. Yeah. So like wrapping around ChatGPT, oh, okay. Right? Like you're not building your own models. You're handing all the data and everything proprietary over to ChatGPT, which sucks. But like, don't waste your time spending all this money and effort and building and training a model when then you find out there's no opportunity. So like that's an appropriate approach. Whereas then there's also like infrastructure layer. So like, very much deeper level AI, building out models, how can we scale like ML ops and you know, areas like that. And so I like to look at the technology as well, and I'm attracted to that. So I want to be a resource as much as I can. Right now we're in program, so I'm obviously limited with time, but like, we're, you know, next year, we're investing in 24 AI companies. And so even if I spoke to you, you know, last year for the program, it doesn't mean this year you won't be the right fit. Like, I, at the end of the day, like, just talk to me, send us updates.
If you'd like, I can help you look for them, the App Store.
All right, you triggered Siri somehow. and it muted you in the process. Can you say the last part? You said if it wasn't the right fit, apply this year, then it kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, come, you know, like, it. So what's interesting about Techstars is that, like, my hope is that you don't need Techstars, right? Like, you're moving so fast that, like, a year window is light years for a founder. Like, you just move so quickly. And so it's hard when you're running programs, if you're running every year, because then you can miss the opportunity with a really great founder. And like, that's great. Maybe it's, you go to a different program, or maybe you don't need Techstars anymore, and that's the best case scenario for you. But in any case, like, I'm like, come talk to us. If you applied to the program last year, and you didn't get in, it doesn't matter. Most founders apply 3 times before actually getting into a Techstars.
So just continuing on that theme of investing, obviously it's a down market. The sentiment over the last year has been a lot of investors saying the dry powder's out there. And then on the other side, I hear a lot of founders being like, yeah, but no one's actually deploying it. So in the current funding climate, like, what do you think is key for a startup to really break through and gain investment?
I mean, so AI is a bit of an outlier, which is really good for everyone in the room, right? Like, I have AI companies and I have non-AI companies, and the non-AI companies are struggling much more. It sucks right now. It really sucks. I mean, it's a correction in the market, so it's a good thing. I struggle a lot with the VC market. As a founder, I hated VCs. It felt like a lot. VCs to me felt like a lot like coaches that had never played the sport before. And I was like, how can you coach when you've never actually done this? Like, I get so irritated about, you know, just people who are trying to, who have all the power with money, and they're trying to dictate what like, tell you what is good and not good about what you're doing, or like that you're wrong and they're right. That to me was hard. And so I was like, if I'm going to come to TechStars, I want to do this differently. I want to have empathy as an investor and be like, I know what you're going through. Let's figure this out together. I think that's honestly a big failure on the VC market, and that the reason why there is a, why the market must correct itself right now, because a lot of investors are not that smart, and they're making bets because of FOMO. They're like, they're seeing a few other investors moving on deals, and so they just want to throw into a deal. There's a reason why a lot of VCs won't quote unquote lead around, because they don't have the conviction or the passion or the know-how to really understand whether it's a good opportunity or not. And that's, I think, one big part of the problem. And it's just, yeah, I have a lot of issues with VC, but at the end of the day, we as founders need VC. We need funding to grow and to scale. And so you have to play the game. So for, you know, the AI space right now, there's a lot of money people are throwing at startups. What will benefit you as a founder, that I tell my companies mainly, is like, it's traction. Like, customer at the end of the day is all that matters. If you have customers lining up out your door waiting to pay you, every investor is going to be throwing money at you. And so, like, I tell them, like, don't waste your time trying to like just build hype with investors and get them all excited. Like, the way to create hype and FOMO when you're fundraising is purely by having amazing traction with customers. Like, you can't, no one can speak against that. And the companies that I invest in that have bootstrapped and are like killing it right now, generating, you know, 300 plus ARR, 300K plus ARR, like, investors are like desperate to put money into them. And they're like, how have you been able to do this? So I know that's much easier said than done. But if you're just starting out, I would say, like, hopefully you're in a position where you can take some risk. And just focus on the customer, because it's not worth your time trying to build something when you don't have traction with customers. Like, why take on funding, in my mind, and give up part of your business when you just don't even know if there's an opportunity or not? And so, like, figure out who the customer is, what their problem is, and see what traction you can get. And from there, you will have more and more investors lining up. Again, easier said than done, especially for non-traditional, you know, for people who are not white guys from Stanford. Like, it's much, much harder. And I understand that. Luckily, there are more investors who care more about those things and are actively looking for founders that don't look like the traditional entrepreneur.
More on the way in my interview with Trisha, but in an interview that's all about software and AI, my question for you is, who are you using to build your software and your AI? Akeva is the goat of software development. Now listen, I've seen too many startups get screwed over by offshore or budget dev shops. You know what those providers are doing? They are doing the bare minimum. And you know why? It's because they're only order takers, which often means you have software with gaping holes, or you're forced to pay hidden release fees to claim ownership of your code. And then there's Akeva, who actually builds strategically for scale from day one, helps you make product decisions, and gives you full ownership of your code by default. And that's whether you're building in AI or machine learning or building an LLM or just building a straight up standard consumer app or anything in between. And they've got a killer offer just for you, the Startup Hype Man community. It's a You Call It code review. What's that? Well, for those who qualify, Akeva will review the most critical parts of your code so you can see exactly what your tech needs to launch or scale. And they do this completely free, and then you call it from there. Want to handle things on your own? You call it. Want to get Akeva's dev help? You call it. Want to take it somewhere else? You call it. It's like, remember when you were at the bar and they had $1 or $3, you call it shots. But at the bar, it was like Wednesday night and it was only well liquor. Well, this is the opposite of that. This is you call it and you actually have good options in front of you at the end of the day. Ready for your You Call It code review? Ready to get goated? Head to akava.io. That's akava.io. Akava.io. Or you can tap the link that's in this episode description. And when you get there, tell them Startup Hype Man sent you. Back now to the show.
I should have asked this next question actually a little bit ago. But I did want to, I do still want to ask it because I did put into ChatGPT yesterday. I said, I'm interviewing Trisha Martinez-Saab in a fireside chat tomorrow about investing in AI and the future of AI. What are some good questions I can ask her? One of them that came back was, this is why I said I probably should have asked it a couple questions ago. As AI continues to advance, ethical considerations become increasingly important. How do you approach investing in AI startups with a focus on responsible and ethical innovation?
So I think that's a really important question for investors, right? Like we see this now happening with shitty companies who, right, we'll see WeWork, Theranos, like why were investors not asking enough questions before? You know, Sam Bankman-Fried, is that why, right? Like, I think Andreessen didn't ask any questions and they were just like throwing, like, they were like, yeah, of course we'll throw a lot of money. And it's like, that is the problem. Because it's like this herd mentality, this FOMO, like, well, if everyone else is doing it, then I'm doing it. That's a big problem because as an investor, when you're investing in things, you need to ask the harder questions. And AI is opening up a can of worms. Like, I don't have any of these fears around like doomsday stuff or that like AI is going to take over or that it's going to become sentient anytime soon. Like, we're very far away from that. But there are like the ethical questions, and that's more of around like bias and like we are building technologies that could impact other things. So like, you know, the work I was doing at DOE, and I did a lot of work with DOD too, and they're using AI, and right, like I have companies that work with DOE for drones technology, for warfare technology. You have to decide what you're comfortable with, like, but at the end of the day, also, like, as an investor, you should ask the tough questions, because the companies that you're putting money in are potentially could be influencing society and how consumers and other businesses interact with that technology. So I don't think we know what questions to ask yet, right? Like, you know, most of the companies don't really understand, but that's also the problem, is like before we're able to ask questions, it then becomes massive. And, you know, I can guarantee stuff with like Theranos and some of these other companies. I mean, they were asking questions. She was just a sociopath, and so she was really good at not answering. But like, those are things to consider as well. Like that when ethics come into play as a society and as people with the checks, we have to ask questions, even though it might make some people uncomfortable.
I've got one more question and then I'll open it up to the audience here if they've got anything for a couple of minutes. This question is, complete the sentence, by the end of 2024, AI will blank.
Oh, that's a hard one. So I think by the end of 2024, I don't think we'll have much movement with AI, to be honest. Like, I think that, that's a year from now, right? We're in 2023 right now. I think things are moving fast, but I think we're at this point where we're largely just going to see a lot of content, media, consumer-related things. For me, like, the bigger opportunities around climate and health, like super impactful AI, it won't come for, like, we won't see drastic changes influencing society probably for at least 5+ years. So I think end of 2024, like, we'll see another ChatGPT. A lot of the bigger players are going to be competing, and there'll be a lot of startups who are trying to build on top. And what we'll end up seeing is like the application companies, that's where the winners are. you know, some of the bigger businesses are going to own infrastructure, but companies who own relationships with customers in the AI world, they will be the ones winning, and they're going to get acquired by a lot of these big players.
So open up the floor. We got a couple minutes here for audience questions. Yeah, why don't you come up so as you can see, and then I'll give you the microphone as well so you can hear.
I know your name and then your question.
Hello, I'm Alex Stanford with Skytrade and Vapebot AI.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And I was wondering, the partnerships you have with like big entities, right? You know, you're literally talking to literal governments. Was it, you know, I know a guy or I have to know somebody to get in there, or was it literally just as easy as, you know, anything else? You go to the website, you know, government.org, and you're able to get, you know, emails and contacts that way.
So partnerships with governments, like during my startup days, or so I think one of my superpowers as a founder was mobilization. Like I felt like I was just constantly, I was always, I tell the companies I work with, like LinkedIn, if you have the ability to craft a nice thought out message, and also you're not like spamming people, but like a critiqued or a very specialized message for each person, I had like 90% success rate. So like governments, large enterprise, like I would get in front of really impressive people, mainly just because I was like, I'm seeking your advice. Please, like we're building this, we're trying to change the world. I would love your advice. Can I talk to you? And so that's generally, honestly, like LinkedIn is how I've just like got so many relationships and meetings. And I think there's like, it's an art because I get pinged by people where I'm like, this is feels spammy and I don't want to talk to you. But then I get messages that are really well thought out. And I'm like, I do want to talk to you because you did your research. So I would say, you know, taking that approach can be helpful. But then obviously over time, as you build more relationships, then more and more people, because they know you as a founder, are going to be like, hey, I want to introduce you to so-and-so. And so I think to me, you know, what I learned, probably, I think you might've asked this question, and I probably would have said this. I think your greatest asset as a founder is your network. And it's your responsibility to build and nurture the network, mainly because your network follows you wherever you go. So whether it's the startup or your next one, like I learned that I have people in my network that are following me and they want me to succeed and they see how hard I worked before. And they're like, I want to keep supporting you. And so you though have to really grow that. So early on with my career, I was so bad at like keeping up to date with people and just like touching base and updating them. Now I realize how important it is. And so I tell the companies I work with, like, you have to send regular updates, be proactive, give back to them because it will pay back. It's karma. It definitely pays back. So I would say like for anything now, I don't know what you're working on or you know, if this is relating to like a startup you're building, but focus on your network. And it feels like work and it feels like nobody's listening, but I promise you they are and it will pay back.
And I'll tell everyone too, it's amazing how not hard it is to find people's email addresses and be a smoke of honor.
But I don't like that. I'm like, I don't cold email because then I'm like, if someone cold emails me, I'm like, how'd you get my email? But on the LinkedIn, it's nice because, right, like you can see someone. And then I'm like, oh, I know who this person is. We have some shared connections. Even though LinkedIn's lame, like it's not the best platform, it's still, I think, better than like a cold email, in my opinion.
As someone who does a lot of cold email, I will have a different stance on it.
and I'll tell you, when people are like, if ever someone's like, how'd you get my email? I'll reply, I go, it's 2024. Just be thankful I don't have your social security number.
But that's also like phone calls. I'm like, why is somebody calling me right now? I'm definitely not picking up. Like, just text me.
All right. It's preference. Any questions we have from the audience? I can see you on the camera, so just raise your hand and I'll bring you up.
Okay.
So
yeah, go ahead. Up here.
Hi, my name's Roger. Nice to meet you, Tricia. I think it was about a month ago, there was a lot of conversations within the news about slowing down on AI. and having whether it was agreements between companies or agreements between countries in terms of putting the brakes on AI until we really got our arms around it. And obviously there was a lot of fear talk in the media at that time. On the other hand, my thought is that not everyone is going to sign that agreement. And you know, whether it's a country or a company, you know, there will be companies and countries that don't sign that will be advancing past us. And they'll be like, oh, shoot, you know, why did we slow down? But I see both sides. I see we've got to be careful with, you know, this very strong power that's starting to emerge. And on the other hand, we don't want to be left in the dust. So I was just interested in your thoughts.
Oh, first of all, who the heck could even slow it down, right? Like it's uncontrollable. And right, like it's a community of developers who are building, founders, developers, people who are so passionate and are just going to keep building because of the opportunity. So, I mean, was this a government? Like, who said let's slow it down? Like government?
I've seen it for both. I've seen it both for CEOs of.
Okay.
I've also seen like governments coming together and saying we need to slow this down.
So one, it's like grassroots. You can't stop the people from wanting to do something. I will say, like I've said this before, I call bullshit on the big companies who are like, oh, let's slow it down. We need to regulate. That's because they're trying to build a moat. They don't want other startups to build and be successful and take away from their bottom line. So like that to me is the frustrating part. It's like you have big players, the Googles and Microsofts and Amazons that are building in this space, and they want us to slow down, but that's in large part because they are trying to capture more market share. So I'm like, I don't believe that. And I don't know. I mean, some might actually believe. There are some people who are like very scared of like the doomsday stuff. Every, you know, PhD in AI, you know, I worked with all the national laboratories and those are like leaders in AI. Like no one there is scared. We're still so unbelievably far away from that, if it even is a reality. So I think there are so many things we need to get right and do, take time to assess and do appropriately. And like, that's where the government comes in and why the White House making a stance on this is important. But like I said before, there's just so much ignorance around the technology, which is where I'm scared, what I'm scared of. And if we end up slowing down, then China speeds up. And China, from the government perspective, is our adversary. And we will be very fearful if they're a leader in AI and take over compared to us. So like, you can't really win. And it's not possible to slow down. So all we can do is get our shit together and figure it out.
Sounds great. Thank you. You got time for one more question?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. Go ahead. I saw over my shoulder here.
Yes, yes.
Good evening. Thank you so much for talking with us. My name is Melanie Monique. I run a voice consultancy for humans and AI. I heard you mention earlier about how important it is for PCs to have a conversation with potential startups about ethics, but how hard or how much are you talking to the founders that you interface with about really looking at ethics as they build their AI products and platforms?
That's a great question. I was working with somebody at responsible Google AI, being like, hey, can you come do an AI ethics workshop for us, for our founders? Because a lot of the companies, two of them in the front row, they're moving a million miles per hour. And, you know, to slow down, to think about things like ethics is not always top of mind. I know it's important for them, but like, where do you go? Where do you get those resources? So I have yet to find someone that can put on a workshop. If you have ideas, if anyone else have ideas, I'm open to them.
Absolutely. I sit on the Linux and Open Voice Network Ethical Use Task Force, and that we're all about education and advocacy. And so I would
reach out to
founders can have that information. Absolutely, because it's so important.
Okay, love it. Please send me an email.
All right, thank you.
And then it won't be a cold. Yeah, it'll be warm.
All right, everybody, let's give Trisha a big round of applause.
I'm all about being in person, so I apologize I couldn't be there with you guys. I'm happy to give my email if any of you want to reach out. Happy to have a conversation and learn about what you're building and see if I can help.
Now, before we let you go, Tricia, in the spirit of generative AI, I'm going to redo that prompt for everybody. Let's send her off, but with a lot of hype and like she's the greatest person ever. So stand up. Give it up for Tricia Martinez.
Thanks, everyone. Bye, you guys.
Thank you for doing this even while feeling ill. We hope you feel better, and hopefully we'll get a chance
Thank
to catch
you. Up. Yes, I appreciate you all. Thanks, you guys. Keep building.
That'll put a bow on this one. Before we head out of here, a couple quick housekeeping items. Number one, did you like what you heard? Well, give us a subscribe and a follow. Maybe share it with one friend who you think would find this valuable. Number two, remember that Ask Me Anything I told you about at the end of the episode? That goes down exclusively inside of Goat to Market Club, our online founder and startup community. And you can access it for free. Your membership is 100% free at startuphypeman.com/GTM-club. Number three, need pitch help? Startup Hype Man is your man. Whether it's a fundraising narrative or a go-to-market or category narrative, we've got you covered to make sure you have messaging that doesn't help you just go to market, but of course, what? Helps you become the goat to market. All right, we will see you next week here on the Goat to Market Show. Thank you for listening. And remember, why be a unicorn when you can be the goat?